Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, April 17th, 2024. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. Starting on today's front page, here is our first headline. Budget taxes still on agenda as session nears end. Legislature hits 100th day when lawmakers' per diem allowance ends, by Caleb McCullough. Iowa's majority Republican lawmakers are angling for a quick wrap-up to this year's legislative session as they look toward funding the state government and cutting taxes, along with the last remaining policy items on their agenda. Tuesday marked the 100th day of the legislative session and the last day lawmakers will receive their per diem allowance, which is usually the goal for gaveling out for the year, though the session often goes over that deadline. But lawmakers are optimistic they will hammer out final agreements between the Republican-controlled House and Senate, as well as the governor's office, in the coming days. "We're going to continue to press as fast as possible to get through session," House Speaker Pat Grassley said last week. "I'm not going to make a prediction, but a lot of progress, while it may not feel like it, seeing it happen through legislation. Behind the scenes and working out arrangements, that is happening." As the finish line looms until next year, here are the top priorities for Iowa lawmakers before they conclude the session. Lawmakers are finalizing their plans to spend nearly $9 billion in state funds for the upcoming budget year. Both chambers, along with the governor, have set out budget targets for how much they seek to spend on each area of government, with about $80 million difference between the two chambers. Plans to fund the Education Department, Agriculture and Natural Resources, Judicial System, and other areas of government have passed out of committees in both chambers, but budget leaders have said the top-line figures are likely to change before being sent to Governor Kim Reynolds. Representative Gary Moore, a Republican from Bettendorf who leads the House Budget Committee, said the House was very close to a deal with Senate Republicans on Tuesday afternoon, and the agreements could be finalized this week. Lawmakers may be able to finish the session this week, but they could also go into next week, Moore said. Reynolds proposed an $8.9 billion budget for the state's general fund this year, while the Senate proposed spending slightly less, and the House proposed spending more. Each proposal is well under the $9.7 billion in revenue Iowa is expected to bring in next year. Reynolds' proposed budget would be a 4.7% increase from last year's $8.5 billion in general fund spending. Moore said the budget targets House Republicans set are in line with the party's conservative goals and meet the needs of Iowans. "We want to provide Iowans with enough government, what they expect, but not too much government," he said, "because it's their money, it's not ours." Representative Timmy Brown Powers, Democrat of Waterloo, the ranking member on the Budget Committee in the House, said the budgeting process has moved more smoothly this year than in years past. "Throughout the budget process, Democrats have called for increasing spending in several areas, including Medicaid reimbursement, correctional facilities, and environmental protection." Brown Powers said the higher spending House budget targets were likely the best budgets that we'll see. And she said Democrats would propose amendments to boost spending in areas they think are needed to improve outcomes and meet Iowans' needs. "I think we'll see really good, thoughtful conversations about what Iowans are telling us about what they want and need and where. If we were in charge of the budget, we would have maybe done it a little bit different," she said. Leading Republicans agree they want to cut income taxes before gaveling out this session, but the exact amount is not yet clear. Reynolds proposed a bill to set a flat 3.65% income tax for 2024, which would decrease to 3.5% in 2025. The bill also included changes to unemployment insurance and property tax cuts for commercial child care centers, among other tax breaks. While that bill did not get much traction in the lawmaking process, Representative Bobby Kaufman, Republican of Wilton, said he was expecting to release an income tax deal between the two chambers this week. Reynolds signed a law in 2022 that put Iowa on the path to a flat 3.9% income tax by 2026 and created a system to lower corporate income tax rates. Iowa's top income tax bracket this year is 5.7%, and it would be 4.82% next year if it is not accelerated by a new law. Iowa's tax revenues have largely stayed robust as the tax cuts have taken effect, leading Iowa Republicans to call for deeper tax cuts, arguing that the state is collecting more money than it needs. "Based on our income and what we expect to spend, there is room to speed up tax cuts, absolutely," Moore said. "I think there's opportunity for us to do that." Democrats have continued to argue that income tax cuts, especially a flat tax, disproportionately help the wealthy who receive the largest windfall from the falling tax brackets. Democrats argue the breaks give no financial relief for the thousands of Iowans who pay no income taxes. CO offers Regent price match for Iowa freshmen. College cites flawed rollout of federal student aid form by Vanessa Miller. Taking matters into its own hands, following the U.S. Department of Education's tumultuous rollout of its new student financial aid application, CO College on Tuesday announced a Regent price match aimed at providing immediate help to Iowa students entering college for the first time in the fall. CO's Iowa Ready initiative offers additional scholarships and grants for Iowans entering college for the first time in fall 2024 to ensure direct cost equal to or less than the current average direct cost of Iowa's three Regent universities, which CO reported at $21,060. CO is defining direct cost as including tuition fees, housing, and meal plans, but excluding things like books, supplies, transportation, and other expenses. Many students will see an out-of-pocket cost less than the Regent average of $21,060 as additional scholarships, grants, work study, and loans are applied, according to the CO announcement, citing the flawed federal rollout of a new free application for federal student aid in its need to take drastic action. In my 30 years in higher education, this is one of the most significant barriers I've seen for Iowa families to make a college decision, co-director of financial aid Barb Hoffman said. With FAFSA filing rates in Iowa down 32% from last year and the national filing rate down 38%, according to a federal tracker, CO, in announcing the offer, said, "It's clear Iowa families are unable to pursue their college choice due to the lack of information associated with the delayed FAFSA rollout and the subsequent setbacks caused by the implementation of the FAFSA simplification. Plus," officials said, "changes in FAFSA calculations have especially challenged aid eligibility for farmers and small business owners. All first-time college students need to understand the financial aid they will receive in order to make a decision, and I'm pleased Iowa Ready will accomplish that," Hoffman said. "Knowing your cost to attend CO will be $21,060 or less is valuable information because now it's clear you have college options." Although CO didn't provide specific details on its FAFSA applications for next fall, its admissions and financial team told the Gazette overall the rate at which these are being submitted is significantly lower throughout the state of Iowa. "At CO, we are also seeing a decrease in FAFSA results," the team said. "Some of this is due to incorrect data from the U.S. Department of Education, and some is due to the same circumstances the entire state is experiencing, frustration and confusion on the part of the families working through this process. Some may simply walk away from college altogether rather than dealing with the hassles." CO's hope to prevent that is behind its Regents Match offer. Although, given CO is helping students attain that price through grants and scholarships, the figures are not an apples-to-apples comparison. When the Board of Regents approved rates last summer for the current academic year, averaging to a total combined cost for tuition, fees, room, and board at $20,772, that didn't include grants and scholarships. To be eligible for the Iowa Ready initiative, applicants must be current Iowa residents looking to attend college for the first time in fall 2024. They must first apply for admission to be considered for the initiative and could obtain additional scholarships, grants, work study, or loans. "We are dedicated to ensuring Cohawks have the best in education, resources, and opportunities, regardless of FAFSA processing timelines," Co-President David Hayes said. "Those delays should not inhibit their ability to have options." The Iowa Ready initiative will be available to eligible students through June 1st. Lynn reduces community grant programs in budget. Board of Supervisors to vote today on adopting fair and reasonable fiscal 25 budget by Marissa Payne. After cutting more than $1 million in proposed spending to keep up with the fiscal toll of state tax reform, the Lynn County Board of Supervisors will adopt a fiscal 2025 budget that scales back community grant programs and other discretionary items but bumps elected official and staff pay. The supervisors today are slated to adopt the budget for fiscal 2025, the budget year that spans July 1st through June 30th, 2025. The three-member board meets at 10 a.m. in the formal boardroom of the Gene Oxley Public Service Center, 935 2nd Street Southwest. The county's proposed budget book will not be available until this summer and is not required to be finished until 90 days after budget adoption, but highlights of the budget are included in a PowerPoint presentation on the county's website, lynncountyiowa.gov. It was shared when the supervisors in March held a public hearing to present the budget. To draft the budget, county officials held more than 20 public meetings with department heads and supervisors starting in November. "The budget we put forward was fair and reasonable," Supervisor Chair Kirsten Running Marquardt said. We made our fair share of cuts and kept in mind the balance that we needed to strike with providing a level of excellence of service for people here in Linn County. The countywide levy rate will increase to $6.07 in fiscal 2025 from the current rate of $5.96. The rural rate would drop to $2.63 from $2.71 in fiscal 2025, including a reduction of $1 for rural residents because of the voter-approved local option sales tax allocation. Under the new proposed countywide levy rate, the owner of a house with an assessed value of $200,000 would see a $562.57 annual county tax bill, not accounting for taxes due from other taxing authorities. Valuations for most property owners have changed from year to year. Budget Director Sarah Barrows said in an email that 76% of non-Cedar Rapids County residents will actually see an increase in their taxes to Linn County compared to last year because their home's assessed value rose. The state set residential rollback rate, the percent of a home's value that can be taxed, of 46.3% is the lowest it has been in 45 years. That means now more than half of a home's value can't be taxed, which is bad news for local governments, but relief for taxpayers. The county's proposed expenditure budget is $157.1 million, up $4.9 million, or 3.2%, because of increases in negotiated labor agreements, software contracts, utilities, debt service because of the voter-approved land and water legacy bond issue, and elections to account for precinct and technological requirements. The proposed revenue budget is $157.6 million, a bump of 6.4%, primarily because of an increase in the countywide levy rate, investment earnings, camping revenue, and local option sales tax. That local option sales tax allocation supports $3.8 million for road construction, $1.9 million for conservation, and $1.9 million in property tax relief for rural residents. Of that revenue, property taxes levied totals $83.3 million, an increase of 6.5% from fiscal 2024 because of the increase in the countywide levy rate and valuation growth. There were no approved offers in the fiscal 2025 budget, the county's term for a process where departments can apply for new staff or initiatives that would be supported by general fund dollars. Federal inmate revenue will drop to $1.6 million from $3.6 million after the Linn County Jail is no longer housing federal inmates for the U.S. Marshals Service. The inmates were moved to other county jails in Iowa. After state lawmakers last year passed House File 718 with bipartisan support, Supervisor Ben Rogers said the county's taxable valuation grew 4.4%, but based on that legislation, the county only captured 2.4% of that valuation growth. The bill set triggers to reduce the levy by certain amounts if valuation growth is 3% or more. There were a lot of pressures placed on this board to make some decisions to cut $1.162 million and add about $1.61 million into the general supplemental levy, Rogers said. Last year, after a state error in the rollback formula threw a wrench in local governments' budgets, the supervisors cut spending on various community grant programs and other county initiatives. That included its $50,000 contribution to the Creating Safe, Equitable, and Thriving Communities Task Force, which works to identify the root causes of gun violence and develop strategies to address them. Other funding reduced included the county's Economic Development, Main Street, and Legacy and Community Attraction grants. Supervisor Louis Zumbaugh supported reducing the Sustainability Department's operating budget and downgrading the director role after Tamara Marcus' departure in November, but didn't gain support from the other two supervisors. Rogers warned of more very difficult budget decisions in future years. Zumbaugh, the board's lone Republican, was the only supervisor who opposed passing the draft budget after suggesting nearly $1.397 million in cuts to discretionary spending, more than the $1.162 million in proposed spending cuts the board landed on. "I think we're all three frustrated about where it ended up," Zumbaugh said. "I hope that in future meetings early on that the public does start to coming to meetings and voicing their opinions." Johnson County's proposed budget adds positions, maintains services, by Alejandro Rojas. Johnson County officials have described the proposed budget for next fiscal year as one that includes minor changes, as spending for programs and services were adjusted but not cut. The Johnson County Board of Supervisors will hold a public hearing today on the fiscal 2025 proposed budget, which would run from July 1st through June 30th, 2025. The hearing will begin at 5:30 p.m. in the second floor boardroom of the Johnson County Health and Human Services Building, 855 South Dubuque Street, Iowa City. County officials attributed the little changed budget to legislation passed last year and signed into law by Governor Kim Reynolds. House File 718, which had bipartisan support, is intended to provide tax relief for property owners in the state, but it also limits the amount of growth cities and counties can capture by reducing levies based on percent of valuation growth. Johnson County Finance Director Dana Ashenbrenner wrote in an email that the county has budgeted roughly $170 million in expenditures for next fiscal year. To finance everything, he said the county will use roughly $113 million in revenues, $17 million in borrowings, and $40 million in carried over funds. Rod Sullivan, chair of the Board of Supervisors, said the levy rates for urban and rural areas of the county would both increase. Under the proposed budget, the levy rate for general services countywide would increase to $6.43 per $1,000 of taxable valuation from the current year's rate of $6.06. The levy rate for rural services would increase to $10.42 per $1,000 of taxable valuation, up from the current year's rate of $9.75. Despite the increase, Sullivan said property owners would actually be paying less in property taxes because of the rollback, a state-set rate that determines the percent of a property's value that can be taxed. This year's rollback rate is the lowest it has been in 45 years. Using, as an example, a property with an assessed value of $100,000, Sullivan said urban Johnson County residents would pay $33 less per year, and owners of agricultural land in rural areas would pay $171 less. Guillermo Morales, Johnson County Executive Director, said the county approached this year's budget process cautiously because of changes at the state level. He described the budget as having minor changes, but said the county worked to keep the budget flat. Among the additions to this year's budget are new employees. That includes 9.6 new full-time equivalent county paramedics. Of those, 5.6 FTEs are contingent on a contract with University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Morales said those 5.6 FTEs would be budget neutral because they would be paid for by UIHC. The budget also will add two positions to the county attorney's office, a public safety and justice public information officer, and a county investigator position. Morales said no cuts had been made to county programs, services, or staffing, but those things also did not increase substantially because of the state's new rule that limits how much growth can be captured. It's just a matter of not being able to do the things we had hoped we would be able to do because we aren't able to capture the benefit of increased property values, Morales said. He said heading into budget discussions, many department heads and elected officials had been asking for additional staff. Examples include the sheriff asking for a new administrative assistant and the Board of Supervisors office hoping to add another employee. There were a few kinds of asks from department heads and elected officials that, you know, the board just didn't have the ability to grant, given how uncertain things are, and given the limitations that have been put in place by the state legislature, he said. This frustration was echoed by Sullivan, who said there is a desire to grow and expand services as the population in the county increases. When it came to adding new staff positions, Sullivan said the supervisors made decisions based on their opinions of what they think the county needs, informed by speaking with staff. Bill reorganizing boards and commissions sent back to Senate. Bill was written based on recommendations by a review committee by Caleb McCullough. Iowa House lawmakers passed a bill to reorganize and cut the number of administrative boards and commissions in Iowa, but the proposal must be agreed to by the Senate before being sent to the governor for a signature. The bill, Senate File 2385, would eliminate dozens of state boards and commissions or consolidate them under other boards. Administrative boards have a range of duties, including rulemaking, overseeing professions, advising state agencies, and allocating budgets. The Senate passed the proposal last week, but the House amended the bill and sent it back to the chamber for approval. It passed the House 54-42. The bill would create a new state government efficiency review committee that would regularly review the state's boards and commissions. The committee, which would be tasked with reviewing a quarter of the boards each year, would evaluate a board's efficiency and effectiveness and make recommendations for changes or elimination. Representative Jane Bloomingdale, Republican of Northwood, who managed the bill of the House, said the review committee was the most important piece of the bill. "We're setting up a review committee that we've talked about since I was elected 8 years ago," Bloomingdale said. "If we made a mistake, if we feel like the merged boards weren't right, we'll unmerge them." Various measures in the bill would remove authority that is given to state boards and bring them under the agency or department they serve, giving executive staff appointed by the governor more rulemaking and decision-making power. Several boards and commissions that meet on a set schedule would be changed to meet on an as-needed basis, and the bill would require government bodies at all levels to run hybrid meetings that allow for remote participation. Democrats who hold a minority in both chambers filed a number of amendments and argued the bill would take power away from important boards, including the boards serving underrepresented communities. Pointing to the move of rulemaking authority under executive agencies, Democrats argued the bill would consolidate power under the governor and away from the volunteer bodies. We had the opportunity to come together, get rid of some boards and commissions that were clearly unnecessary, and make a government that is more efficient and listens to Iowans, said Representative Adam Zabner, Democrat of Iowa City. What we ended up with was a power grab that takes away the rights of Iowans and the voices of Iowans in the process of government. Proposed tax incentives for billion-dollar projects passes, sent to governor. Qualifying projects must have total investment of at least $1 billion, by Aaron Murphy. A $93 million package of state tax incentives designed specifically to entice billion-dollar economic development projects to Iowa was approved by the state lawmakers Tuesday and needs just Governor Kim Reynolds' signature to become law. The proposed incentive program, which was designed by the state's Economic Development Agency, would be made available to projects in Iowa that invest at least $1 billion and span at least 250 acres. The incentives would include an investment tax credit, a sales tax refund on construction costs, and a withholding tax credit on wages. If qualifying megasite projects are approved, the program would cost the state $93 million in the first year, and then $18 to $19 million at full implementation, according to projections from the state's nonpartisan legislative services agency. Separately, local governments could provide property tax relief as an additional incentive, the agency noted. To qualify for the incentives, a project would be required to be located on a site greater than 250 acres and make investments totaling at least $1 billion, be primarily engaged in advanced manufacturing, biosciences, or research and development, create jobs that pay at least 140% of the qualifying wage, and provide comprehensive benefits to each employee. Not have a record of violations as determined by the State Economic Development Agency. Businesses with existing facilities that meet the qualifications also would be eligible for the incentives. Debbie Durham, director of the Iowa Economic Development Authority, told the Gazette last year that the state missed out on luring a large solar energy manufacturer to Iowa because of a lack of the kind of incentives in the agency's proposal. An agency spokeswoman repeated that during a legislative hearing on the proposal earlier this year. The company went to Louisiana instead, Senator Bill Dotzler, a Democrat from Waterloo, said Tuesday during Senate debate. It's unfortunate that this delay occurred, but I know that the Economic Development Authority are working on some projects here in Iowa, and I really hope this will entice them to land here in Iowa, Dotzler said. Having passed both chambers of the Iowa legislature, the proposal now heads to Reynolds for her consideration. Reynolds' office did not immediately respond to a request for comment Tuesday. Groups ask EPA to protect drinking water. Petition announced after Iowa regulators approved largely status quo CAFL rules, by Aaron Jordan. Iowa environmental groups, inspired by a successful campaign in Minnesota, are asking the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to step in and protect drinking water in northeast Iowa from agricultural runoff. The petition was announced Tuesday, hours after the Iowa Environmental Protection Commission unanimously approved largely status quo rules governing animal feeding operations. The Environmental Protection Commission has once again proved who they really serve, not the public, but big ag polluters, said Alicia Vasto, water program manager for the Iowa Environmental Council, one of 13 groups that filed the petition with the EPA on Tuesday. The petition asked the EPA to use its emergency authority to intervene in Iowa to address groundwater contamination that presents an imminent and substantial endangerment to the health of residents in northeastern Iowa. The well-documented nitrate contamination of drinking water in the karst region necessitates prompt and decisive EPA emergency action, the petition states. Elevated levels of nitrate in drinking water are known to increase the risk of a wide range of very serious health problems. A 2018 review of 30 academic studies showed a link between ingesting nitrate from drinking water and adult diseases, including colorectal cancer. Other University of Iowa studies show nitrate consumption may cause bladder and ovarian cancer in older women, the Gazette reported last month. Nitrate is found at potentially harmful levels in 1 in 20 Iowa public drinking water systems, and in more than 12,000 private wells in Iowa. The petition focuses on Iowa's Driftless region, where porous karst terrain makes streams and groundwater particularly vulnerable to fertilizer or manure runoff. just across the state border to the north, the EPA in November told the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to develop a plan for addressing nitrate levels in drinking water resources in southeastern Minnesota. This EPA demand came 6 months after environmental groups in Minnesota filed a petition comparable to what Iowa groups filed Tuesday. We've seen similar increases in nitrate in drinking water sources, just like in Minnesota, said Michael Schmidt, an attorney for the Iowa Environmental Council. We would expect the EPA to do at least as much in Iowa. Before approving revisions to Chapter 65 of Iowa's administrative rules, the Iowa Environmental Protection Commission on Tuesday held a public hearing at which 11 people asked for tougher regulations on how developers build feeding operations and dispose of manure. Three people representing agricultural groups spoke in favor of the rules. The DNR's first version of the Chapter 65 revision last fall included additional requirements for feeding operations in the karst terrain of northeast Iowa. The version released in September said new CAFOs proposed to be built between 5 and 15 feet from karst would have been required to have a 5-foot continuous layer of low permeability soil, non-soluble bedrock, or a 2-foot synthetic clay liner. However, revisions sent to the EPC in November removed those additional separation requirements after the governor's office told the DNR the proposed revision violated an executive order from Governor Kim Reynolds that barred more restrictive rules. One change that remained in the final version says the DNR will adopt a 100-year floodplain map so developers will know where feeding operations can't be built. And we'll finish our first half hour with some items from today's Capitol Notebook feature. Bill to prohibit firearms tracking headed to Reynolds' desk. Financial institutions operating in the state would be prohibited from using a merchant code for credit card transactions at gun retailers meant to detect suspicious firearms and ammunition sales under a bill headed to Governor Kim Reynolds' desk, even though lobbyists have said credit card companies don't plan to use the codes in Iowa. The bill would prevent banks and credit card companies from using a merchant code that would differentiate a firearms retailer from any other retailer. Supporters of the bill have said it aims to prevent financial institutions from creating a de facto gun registry. Gun rights advocates said the code is an infringement on privacy and Second Amendment rights. Democrats questioned the need for the legislation. What is the problem we're trying to curb, and is it occurring today in Iowa? Representative David Jacoby, Democrat of Coralville, asked Bill Floor Manager Representative Ray Sorensen, Republican of Greenfield. Not that I'm aware, but it very well could, and that's what we're preemptively trying to stop, Sorensen responded. Ban on guaranteed income programs passes. After a lengthy debate that centered on the role of government in lifting people out of poverty, Iowa Senate Republicans approved legislation that would prohibit guaranteed basic income programs in Iowa, sending the proposal to Governor Kim Reynolds. Uplift Iowa, a project involving 4 central Iowa local governments and a number of businesses and nonprofits, is the only existing guaranteed income program in the state. The pilot program provides 110 residents with monthly payments of $500 that can be spent without restrictions. Uplift Iowa is set to last 2 years, ending in spring 2026. Under the bill, the project would be allowed to continue, but no future guaranteed income programs could be started. Democrats criticized the bill for prohibiting local governments from experimenting with basic income programs, and argued Republicans were being hypocritical by opposing basic income programs while supporting taxpayer-funded subsidies for farmers. House File 2319 passed the Senate on a mostly party-line 35-13 vote, with all Republicans supporting and most Democrats opposing. Having previously passed the House on a similarly party-line vote, the bill moves to Reynolds for her consideration. House passes bill to publicize school vaccine exemptions. House lawmakers passed a bill requiring schools and child care centers to publish information about exceptions to vaccination requirements in any communications about those requirements to parents. Iowa law requires children in child care centers, elementary schools, and secondary schools to be immunized against a variety of infectious diseases, but parents can obtain exceptions for medical and religious reasons. The bill, Senate File 2196, does not change any exemption rules, but it would require schools and child care centers to provide information about exemption options to parents when they explain the required vaccines. The exemptions would also need to be published online. The bill passed the House 77-20, with all no votes being Democrats. It now goes to the Senate, which will need to approve the amended language to send it to Governor Kim Reynolds for a signature. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, April 17th, 2024, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Walter Earl Bruce, age 89, of Shellsburg, died Monday, April 15th at his rural Shellsburg home. Visitation will be from 9 until 11 a.m. on Friday, April 19th. Memorial service 11:30 a.m. Friday, April 19th at Oak Grove Christian Church in Shellsburg, with Reverend Matt McGee officiating. Walter Earl Bruce was born February 21, 1935, in Shellsburg, son of Willis and Hazel Van Dyke Bruce. He was a 1953 graduate of Shellsburg High School. He married Martha Jean Petro on March 31, 1957, at Oak Grove Christian Church near Shellsburg. He was a lifelong member of the Oak Grove Christian Church and was active in leadership most of his life. He loved serving the Lord at Oak Grove. He worked at Lefebure Corp for 47 years, retiring in 2000. He was also active in farming at his home near Shellsburg. Memorials can be sent to Oak Grove Church or SimUSA, care of Oak Grove Church in Shellsburg. Online condolences, phillipsfuneralhomes.com. Don Shorts Thomas Armin, 56, of Alburnett, passed away on Saturday, April 13th. A celebration of life will be held from 2 to 5 p.m. on May 11th at the Central City American Legion. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family with arrangements. Don was born on July 13, 1967 in Long Beach, California, the son of Don and Judy Stegel Armin. He was a graduate of Washington High School and went on to attend the University of Iowa. On October 11, 1997, Don was united in marriage to Angie Koba at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids. Through the years, Don was employed by Technographics in Iowa City, J&A Printing in Hiawatha, and most recently at Lynn Co-op in Springville. Don enjoyed most sporting events, specifically anything Iowa Hawkeyes or golf-related, but his greatest joy was spending time with friends and family. Don will be greatly missed by all who knew and loved him. In lieu of flowers, memorials in Don's memory may be directed to the family. Please share a memory of Don at murdochfuneralhome.com. Scott Blake Garski of Deer Park, Illinois, passed away on April 6th in Deer Park at age 69 from complications of a brain tumor. He was born on January 6, 1955, to Alfred Blake and Edith Caroline Skirdell Garski in Grand Forks, North Dakota. He spent his growing up years in Waterloo, Iowa, Columbia, Missouri, and Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where he graduated from Washington High School. Scott loved his sports, beginning with Little League Baseball and going on to be an Iowa High School All-State Baseball pitcher. He also played varsity football and basketball in high school. He received a baseball scholarship at the University of Iowa. He graduated from Iowa with a bachelor's degree in business administration. His career included sales for Procter & Gamble and Enterprise Systems, a startup hospital inventory software company in Chicago. His business career was cut short when he was diagnosed with a brain tumor in 1988. Scott began teaching Tai Chi in 2004 and was a Taoist internal healing arts teacher, teaching several classes a week throughout the Northwest Chicago suburbs. He was especially proud to teach free classes for cancer survivors. Scott was an avid cyclist, doing several ragbris in the Des Moines Register's annual Great Bike Ride across Iowa. He also enjoyed cross-country skiing. Memorial contributions can be made to the Balnati Brain Tumor Institute via the Northwestern Memorial Foundation. For information, please contact Davenport Family Funeral Home, Crystal Lake, Illinois. For online condolences, please visit davenportfamily.com. Urban J. Keenan, 94, of Olwine, died peacefully on Monday morning, April 15th, at the Views of Marion. Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m., Monday, April 22nd, at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Olwine. Visitation, 4 to 7 p.m. on Sunday, and from 9 to 10 a.m. on Monday, at the Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home in Olwine. Fourth Degree Knights of Columbus Rosary, 4:30 p.m. on Sunday at the Funeral Home. Interment, Woodlawn Cemetery, Olwine. Cards may be mailed to 3372 64th Street Drive, Lot Number 8, Palo, 52324. Online obituary at jamesonschmitzfuneralhome.com. Jean Wegman Cox, 96, of Manchester, passed away peacefully at her daughter's home in Manchester on April 6th with her family at her side. Services will be April 27th at 11 a.m. at St. Mary Church in Manchester. Visitation will be held from 9 a.m. until 10:45 a.m. at the church. A private interment will be held at a later date. Jean was born to Ludwig and Patronella Talkie Wegman on August 4, 1927 in Dyersville. She married Francis Cox on January 10, 1950. They had three children. Louis John Roman, 87, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on April 14th at Cottage Grove Place in Cedar Rapids. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, April 19th at Brosh Chapel in the Abba Center in Cedar Rapids. Funeral Mass will be 10:30 a.m. Saturday, April 20th at St. Ludmilla Catholic Church. Burial will follow in St. John's Cemetery. Lewis was born on October 11, 1936, in Cedar Rapids, the son of Frank and Mary Prohaska Grohman. He graduated from St. Wenceslaus Catholic High School. He began working at Collins Radio until joining the United States Navy for 4 years in the submarine service. Following, he returned to Collins. Lewis was united in marriage to Mary Lou Hahn on September 2, 1961, at St. Wenceslaus Catholic Church. He retired from Collins in 1991 and then began a new career as the leader of the bingo program at St. Ludmilla. During this time, he was instrumental in updating and growing the program for over 9 years. He then worked for the city of Cedar Rapids part-time as a parking lot attendant for 9 years. Memorials may be directed to the family. Online condolences may be expressed to the family at broshchapel.com. That concludes today's obituaries. Moving on to the editorial page, there is one letter to the editor today. It is from Cheryl Makovec of Springville. Headline reads, "Thank you to Caitlin Clark, the GOAT of women's basketball." Thank you, Caitlin Clark, for playing basketball here in your home state of Iowa, where the roots of girls' basketball run deep. Thank you for staying home to share your talent, your hard work, your joy in the game, and bringing fans from near and far, as well as new fans, to Hawkeye women's basketball and the state of Iowa. My husband and I have loved watching you play and growing the sport, in addition to watching all your teammates. It has been a joy to see your teammates improve and play so well alongside of you, which makes it so hard to say goodbye to not only to you, but to some of them as well. You can be assured we will be at Carver Hawkeye Arena next season supporting Coach Lisa Bluter, staff, and players as they continue to carry forward this women's program that you have elevated so memorably in your unique and special ways. And, of course, we will be watching and cheering for you in your next chapter in the WNBA. Finally, thank you for sharing the wealth of your fame and accomplishments through your Caitlin Clark Foundation, which will provide many benefits off the court to youth and their communities through education, nutrition, and sport. You are indeed the GOAT in our hearts. That's a letter from Cheryl Makovec of Springville. Here is a guest column by Skylar Snakenberg. We need proactive policies protecting Iowa students. I've been an educator for nearly 14 years and a parent for 9. I've been following legislation regarding the issue of arming teachers in Iowa very closely. Both sides of the political divide are polarized over these acts of violence targeting our schools and children. The left holds they are a result of lax gun laws. The right counters that any effort to pass gun legislation is an attack on the Second Amendment. In an effort to protect our students, the legislature has sent a bill to Governor Kim Reynolds allowing school staff to carry firearms. I applaud their conviction to allow local districts to decide if this is the proper course of action. What works in Wellman might not apply in Des Moines. Letting the parents and school boards have a voice on this issue allows for the best fit for all invested parties. Allowing teachers to choose to be armed should ensure only those who have familiarity and proficiency with firearms are allowed to carry guns on school grounds, someone like me. I am not going to say whether or not I think arming teachers is a good or bad idea. I am also not going to disclose whether or not I will seek out a permit and training to be able to carry in my classroom. But I want to share a revelation I recently had. If I am armed, that means that I am willing to concede at least one student or staff member to harm or loss of life. I am not referring to the life of the shooter. I am talking about the first victim shot. As a teacher, I am not going to draw my weapon and open fire until shots have already been fired. It can be argued that the lives of the many outweigh the loss of one. But who decides the one? It surely couldn't be my children. They are loved by my wife and I dearly. They couldn't be the ones who are in the path of the first bullet. Who will it be? Your child? Passing legislation to arm teachers is reactive, in more ways than one. A teacher won't act without provocation. Neither would an armed officer. We need to adopt proactive measures to get to the root of the issue. This is not only possible, but necessary. Both sides of the political divide are willing to recognize the mental health crisis in our nation. We need to address this more so than the issue of arming teachers. The trauma students have openly shared with me over the course of 14 years would leave people speechless. Some kids turn to drugs and alcohol to anesthetize themselves to the endless refrain of negative thoughts telling them that they are worthless. A smaller but still significant number will attempt suicide. Fewer still will lash out at their communities through terrible acts of violence. Seeing children struggle with these problems and knowing they won't have access to the help they desperately need is heartbreaking. According to February reporting from Iowa news station WHO, Iowa ranks 51st in the nation for providing mental health service. A conversation, not a debate, needs to take place between the parties, with the welfare of our children at its core. The consensus can lead to a net benefit to kids and adults around the state and make strides toward averting another tragedy. Skylar Snakenberg lives in Wellman and is a social studies teacher with 14 years of experience. UI Doctor has a shot at Olympics, one last chance qualifier after hiatus from Greco-Roman wrestling, by Vanessa Miller. About to wrap up an undergraduate degree in biology, finishing in just 3 years while also competing at an international level in Greco-Roman wrestling, a 21-year-old Brandon Marshall in December 2016 stepped on a mat at the U.S. Open in Las Vegas, hoping for a shot to make the world team. In the blood round, an appropriately brutal term used to describe the gut-wrenching match in a tournament that secures a spot on the podium for the winner and a swift exit for the loser, Marshall pulled ahead 7-0, 1 point from winning via technical fall. In fact, with 13 seconds left in the first period, at least one referee scored two more points for Marshall, effectively giving him the win, were it not for a challenge from his opponent that reversed the takedown and sent the match, hanging by a thread, to a second period. "It was in the second half of that match," Marshall said, "I just made a mistake, and the other guy capitalized on it." More than 7 years later, Marshall told the Gazette recently of the 10-7 loss that day. "It stung pretty bad." Adding salt to the wound, Marshall 2 months later found himself on the wrong side of another blood round. "And at that tournament, I got the call for medical school," he said, "so that was the last time I competed." Growing up near Jacksonville, Florida, Marshall returned from his undergraduate stint at Northern Michigan University, one of a handful of U.S. campuses offering a Greco-Roman wrestling team, to pursue a medical degree at the University of Central Florida in Orlando. Focused on school, Marshall didn't have time to train, although the sport maintained its grip on him, compelling him to specialize in orthopedics, which inclined him to rank the wrestling mecca and orthopedic strong University of Iowa atop his residency program preference list. "The only other time I'd ever been to Iowa before I moved up here to buy a house after I'd been accepted was when I wrestled at Kids Nationals in Cedar Falls," Marshall said. "That had to be in the mid-2000s. In the summer of his freshman year in high school, Marshall wrestled 125 matches before an injury sidelined him his sophomore year. That gave him an intimate, if not entirely welcome, introduction to the field of orthopedics. "I've always said that I wanted to do something math or science," Marshall said, but added the care he received through his elbow injury and surgery likely had an influence on his career trajectory. So when his college wrestling career ended, Marshall focused on medicine, leaving no time to train or compete himself. "My hiatus from start to finish was 6 years," Marshall said. "The beginning of the end of that hiatus came with a routine wardrobe decision while house hunting in eastern Iowa for his residency move. I think I was wearing a wrestling t-shirt when we toured the house," which Marshall said led to the discovery the contractor was a wrestler too, "and I told him I was looking for a club to get involved with. Turns out he knew of one, Big Game Wrestling Club in North Liberty. So I started helping out," Marshall said of his entry into Big Game. "I became the coach that showed up when I could, still trying to figure out everything with work." Marshall in December headed back to the U.S. Open, this time in Texas, for a shot at the Olympic trials, and he fell short. Unable to shake the childhood memory of watching his first Olympic trials, though, Marshall earlier this month headed to the last chance qualifier in Virginia. He needed to win it to secure a spot at the trials in State College, Pennsylvania this weekend, and he did. An unseeded UI resident doctor took down the number 3 seed and then the number 2 seed to earn a spot vying for a chance to compete in Paris this summer. "The first Olympic trials that I went to watch was in 2004, and I was like, yeah, that's what I want to do," he said. "And so 20 years later, I might get the opportunity to do that." When reminded he will get the opportunity to do that, Marshall said, "It doesn't feel real." Moving on to sports. Hawkeyes downsized baseball field renovation. Iowa proposes new $5.5 million clubhouse instead of $27.4 million major renovation, by Vanessa Miller. Instead of an originally proposed $27.4 million major renovation of its 50-year-old Duane Banks Field, meant to significantly improve the game day experience and add hundreds of seats for fans, the University of Iowa is paring down its baseball stadium upgrades, for now, due to funding and cost concerns. The revised project proposal going before the Board of Regents next week instead would build a 2,365-square-foot standalone clubhouse next to the first baseline's dugout for $5.5 million, a fifth of the cost of the larger renovation. Due to funding and cost concerns that arose after the intended scope of work was designed, UI Athletics determined the best approach is to advance a smaller project now and do further renovations in the future when associated gift funding becomes available, according to Regent documents made public Tuesday. In 2022, when administrators drafted an initial design proposal, UI Athletics aimed to upgrade the Hawkeye baseball field's press box, bleachers, concourse, and entrance for $18.8 million to $20 million. A tentative timeline at that point had construction starting in June 2023 and wrapping by April 2024. In November 2023, with that initial timeline delayed, UI Athletics proposed a revised budget of $27.4 million, representing a 46% increase to be funded through donations and athletics revenue. That project would have more than doubled the stadium square footage from 6,100 to 12,383 by, among other things, upping the field's permanent seating from 2,100 to 2,492, a 19% increase. UI Athletics at the time said the renovations were badly needed, reporting the field does not meet the State of Iowa Building Code's ADA or plumbing requirements. Duane Banks Baseball Stadium needs an update and an expansion to improve player development, recruitment, and the guest experience, including accessibility and adequate restroom facilities, according to the Board of Regents documents in November 2023. Additionally, the baseball stadium is too small, has poor guest seating, and does not have the required amenities in the press box. The renovation was to include a larger press box, new seating bowl, updated entrance, renovated sprinkler system, new clubhouse, and expanded restrooms and concessions, outfitting it with Americans with Disabilities Act complying ramps, seats, bathrooms, and an elevator. Construction was to start in the fall and finish by spring 2025. The revised project, according to documents going before Regents for approval next week, will focus on existing team and locker room accommodations, which are used before and after practices and games, and need updating and expansion to improve player development and recruitment. Practice and game day support spaces for the team lack proper meeting space, restroom accommodations, ventilation, heating, cooling, and insulation, according to Regent documents. If approved, the revised project would start in the fall and finish in spring 2025 and be paid for with athletics revenue and donations. In addition to the new clubhouse, separate projects to update the lights and turf will occur this summer. By moving forward with a new proposal, the project can advance immediately while fundraising continues for future renovations, according to the UI Office of Strategic Communication. A new press box and upgraded fan amenities are in the planning phase. Duane Banks Field sits along Stadium Drive between Kinnick Stadium and Carver Hawkeye Arena. UI Athletics investigated moving it to a new location but found that would have been much more expensive than renovations. Since the field's inception in 1974, former Hawkeye and former Major Leaguer Cal Eldred in 2002 donated $245,000 for new lights. The field surface was replaced by AstroTurf in 2014-15 when a state-of-the-art video board was installed. This step in the renovation process allows us to prioritize improvements that directly impact the student-athletes, Iowa Athletics Director Beth Getz said in a statement. We look forward to designing the next phases of this project and appreciate the support of our donors as we continue to enhance the experience at Duane Banks Field. Record-breaking crowd in finale has Heartlanders hopeful. Club misses ECHL playoffs but drew 4,878 fans for its finale over the weekend. By Jeff Johnson. He dejectedly sat on a chair at his Extreme Arena office desk, his team just having been stomped by Toledo. Iowa Heartlanders head coach general manager Derek Damon talked about the mistakes his team had made, how it didn't come out ready for this late-season ECHL game. Then he suddenly turned resolute. He's in this for the long haul, he said. He's determined to make the third-year club a playoff qualifier, a Kelly Cup championship contender. There's work to be done, and it's going to get done. We need to put a team on the ice that's going to compete in our division, and our division is a very tough division, Damon said recently. Toledo, the Wheelings, the Fort Waynes, the Indies, even Cincinnati, they're having a tough year, but they're a tough team. At the end of the day, we've made strides in areas. Rome wasn't built overnight, as I like to say. It takes time to do it the right way. But you have to have the culture, and it's getting the right guys in here. We've taken steps in that right direction. The Heartlanders concluded their season over the weekend on a high note. They beat Kansas City 7-4 before a franchise record crowd of 4,878. a good way to go into the offseason, some momentum. They still finished last in the Central Division, last in the Western Conference, with a 27-37-6-2 record. Their 62 standings points were second fewest in the ECHL, ahead of only Atlanta with 50. But this was a better club than last season, more competitive by every account. The Heartlanders went 22-36 to 13-1 last season for 58 standings points. Their inaugural season saw them go 29-33-9-1 for 68 points, largely behind the stellar play of forwards Chris Bennett and Ryan Kuffner, the latter a former NHL player. This was not the step they wanted to take, but it was a step, no doubt. "It's frustrating because I'm competitive and I want to win," said Damon, an assistant coach under Jerry Fleming for the 2021-22 season, before becoming head coach last season. "But I understand where we've come as an organization. The first year, we had two guys who were unbelievable players that carried us. Last year, we had a lot of Southern Professional Hockey League guys, and it took us time. This year, we put a team on the ice, had unfortunate injuries, guys going to Europe. But going forward, it's going to be a much different team next season on the ice." Forward Louis Boudon was Iowa's leading scorer, 46 points in 54 games, and goal scorer, 18. He spent most of the season here despite being on an AHL contract with the Iowa Wild. Forward Casey Dornbaugh, 42 points, was the second highest scorer, another guy on an AHL deal. Third-year forward and fan favorite Yuki Miura played all 72 regular season games and recorded 12 goals and 32 points. The Heartlanders were hurt by mid-season departures of forwards Davis Cook and Odin Tufto to teams in Germany and Switzerland, respectively. "We want guys that are going to wear you down, guys that are going to come to work," Damon said. "It's a long season. You need guys who are willing to put in the work every day. We're making progress towards that." Off the ice, things seem to have been stabilized with new owner Michael Devlin. Iowa ranked at the bottom of the ECHL in attendance, and attendance helps attract players, but at least still has a franchise. Original owner Dean McDonald had one of his franchises, Newfoundland, fold late in the regular season and agreed to sell his other one, Trois-Rivières, to continue its existence. And we have time to finish with today's Sports Day column, which are sporting events in the area today, as well as on television and online. College baseball, Bradley at Iowa, 6:05 p.m. College softball, Hawkeye Community College at Kirkwood, doubleheader, 2 p.m. Luther at Northwestern, Minnesota, 3:30 p.m. Boys golf, Marion at Dyersville Beckman Tournament, Dyersville Golf and Country Club, 9:30 a.m. Girls golf, Marion at Xavier, Twin Pines Golf Course, 9:30 a.m. Regina at Maquoketa Invitational, Maquoketa Country Club, noon. Midwest League Baseball, CR Colonels at Wisconsin, 12:10 p.m. On television, Major League Baseball, Royals at White Sox, 1 p.m., NBCS Chicago. Cubs at Diamondbacks, 2:30 p.m., Marquee. NBA Play-In Tournament, Heat at 76ers, 6:30 p.m., ESPN, ESPN2. Hawks at Bulls, 9 p.m., ESPN. NHL, Maple Leafs at Lightning, 6 p.m., TNT. Blues at Stars, 8:30 p.m., TNT. Pro Soccer, Manchester City versus Real Madrid, 2 p.m., KGAN. College Softball, Wisconsin at Minnesota, doubleheader, 3 o'clock, BTN. College Golf, Western Intercollegiate, 6 p.m., on the Golf Channel. On radio, Major League Baseball, Cubs at Diamondbacks, 2:30 p.m., KXIC. NBA Play-In Tournament, Hawks at Bulls, 6:30 p.m., KGYM. Local talk shows, Todd Brommelkamp Show, 6:30 a.m., KGYM. Gym Class, 3 p.m., KGYM. Spencer on Sports, 4 p.m., KGYM. The listings are supplied by local radio stations. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, April 17th, 2024. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
Roxanne Watson is on a mission.
Hello, how are you doing today?
She wants more people to register as organ, eye, and tissue donors.
Are you an organ donor?
Yes, I am.
Yay!
My goal is to sign up the most people in the United States.
What drives her? Roxanne's own life was saved through the gift of a heart transplant, made possible by an organ donor.
I decided that day that I was going to devote myself to the cause of organ donation and signing people up and honoring my donor by doing that.
Now she's back to health, and she's a powerful force helping to save lives every day through her work. Imagine what you can make possible by leaving behind the gift of life.
8 people can be helped with the major organs, and up to 50 people can be helped with a little bit of everything. And when you think about it that way, that you could help that many people, it's amazing. It really is.
Learn more and sign up as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. Go to organdonor.gov. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.